should represent the voters of District 10. The governor's appointment to lead that Jacksonville neighborhood is getting more controversial by the day. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we'll tell you why the legal and political tangle over this Jacksonville City Council seat is getting more intense. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, out in Neptune Beach, well, residents there are divided over a proposed new development. We'll tell you what's at stake. Plus, the city's Urban Arts Project chooses new talent to enhance the urban core. We'll meet the artists here on the show. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, City Hall is now getting involved in a controversial political appointment that's riled up residents on the Northwest Side. Now, Governor Rick Scott recently made a couple of appointments to the Jacksonville City Council. This after former members Reggie Brown and Katrina Brown were indicted on federal fraud charges. One of those appointments is a Mandarin Republican named Terrence Freeman. He is filling the vacancy in Reggie Brown's City Council District, District 10. The problem with that is that Freeman was still finalizing his residency status even on the day of the gubernatorial appointment. He lives in Mandarin, not the Northwest Side. Now he's running a couple of rooms on the Northwest Side to qualify to represent the district. This has brought sharp criticism from local Democrats and district residents. Former Duval County School Board member Brenda Priestley Jackson sued the governor and Freeman last week, saying this pick is invalid. And here's the latest twist. City Hall is seeking to intervene as a defendant in Priestley Jackson's lawsuit. City Hall filed a motion this week. So there's a lot to get into here. Attorney and political strategist Obi Amuna has been following this flap over District 10 and joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. Who do you think should represent District 10? Do you support or oppose Governor Scott's appointment of Terrence Freeman of Mandarin to represent the Northwest Side on the Jacksonville City Council? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on our Facebook page. Lots of comments there already. We'll get to them in a moment. Okay, Obi, so the new twist on this is that City Hall's attorney filed a motion Tuesday seeking to intervene as a defendant in Brenda Priestley Jackson's lawsuit. She has sued the governor and the new city council appointment, Terrence Freeman, saying this is just not valid because Terrence Freeman did not live in the district when he was appointed.
Right, right. So the city charter is clear that basically says that you need to live in your district to be a city councilman. The question of issue is more, did he live in the district? Did the appointment start when the governor sent out his letter of appointment or when he was actually sworn in?
Exactly. And so as the lawyers go to work, what are people in the district saying?
I've spoken to several residents in the district and they all are pretty much have the same thought. Why not select somebody who lives here? And I think that's what people are kind of not understanding, why they couldn't find someone who lived in the district. Democrats and Republicans are saying the same thing.
Yeah, which led to Brenda Priestley Jackson, a familiar name in local political circles, filing a lawsuit. She isn't saying she wants to represent the district. She's saying that appointing Terrence Freeman is just not legally valid. And we'll have to watch to see how that plays out. She's asked for an emergency hearing.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that was in the lawsuit was that when Brenda Priestley Jackson applied, you had to be a resident in order to apply. That requirement was then taken off, and then Terrence Freeman then applied. And so there's a little bit of issue with how that process went. And I think that's part of the lawsuit as well.
And it's been extraordinary to see the pushback on this, even from the right-leaning editorial page of the Florida Times Union, normally a reliable voice in support of Governor Rick Scott, saying that to the governor, how stupid do you think We all are. We're offended by this.
I was definitely surprised by that. I was definitely surprised that the Florida Times Union editorial board would come out so hard against Rick Scott.
And why do you think, let's talk about the psychology behind this, behind why Jacksonville residents are really so rubbed the wrong way by this.
Well, I'll say this. I think the resident requirement is really a the basis of not only our city charter, but our government as a whole. You want to be represented by your peers, by someone who lives by you. And District 10 is unique, like every other district in the city. And I think people feel like that you want to be represented by someone who knows your neighborhood, knows your struggles.
There's a world of difference, let's be honest, between Mandarin and District 10.
Definitely.
Let's talk about some of the differences.
Well, I think if you look at District 10 from a standpoint of socioeconomic, it's a very diverse district. There are upper class, lower class, all throughout the district. It's also a district that spreads very, it's
pretty far northwest.
Pretty far northwest. And so if you've never lived in that district, you're going to have a trouble even knowing how to get around in that district. Furthermore, even knowing all the different issues that come up in a district like that.
And what would be some of the biggest issues Terrence Freeman or whoever eventually represents the district it would be dealing with?
Any person that's going to go and represent District 10, you're going to want to be able to help bring in jobs. You're going to want to talk about crime. Those are issues that are in every district, but in District 10 even more. Then you're going to also want to talk about the differences in the south part of the district and the north part of the district. Those are two separate places. And so Terrence is going to have to be able to work with both sides of the district, and the district needs totally different things than a district in Mandarin would need. Infrastructure is a huge issue there.
We're talking sidewalks, sewage. Street lights, basic things that folks in that district have for decades said that it's simply not adequate.
There's plenty of people in that district that still do not have city sewage. And so that's been an issue on all of Northwest Jacksonville, but really in District 10 as well.
Now, let's talk about the new wrinkle, City Hall getting involved, filing a motion to intervene as a defendant in this lawsuit. What are your thoughts about that?
I thought it's interesting from a political standpoint because, you know, the mayor's office has had an issue with appointments, Kids Hope Alliance. And so I figured they'd want to just stay on the sideline on this because the governor is the one that necessarily made the appointment. By inserting themselves in this lawsuit, it's clear that they want to be involved and it's clear that they had a say in who was being appointed. And so from that standpoint, I think the people of District 10 are probably going to be more aggravated with the mayor's office because it's clear that they want somebody from their district, not somebody from Mandarin.
Now, at the same time, the Republican Party of Duval County sent a statement out about this earlier this week. I'm quoting, "We urge Democrat, not Democratic, we urge Democrat Party Chairman Lisa King to end her partisan attacks on Councilman Freeman and instead focus on keeping her own elected officials from becoming felons." The whole reason for these appointments of Terrence Freeman and the other appointee was Jacoby Pittman of Clara White Mission is because Katrina Brown and Reggie Brown are under indictment.
Right. I don't know what that statement has to do with the residents of District 10. I think, you know, both parties should want people from their district to represent them. There are Republicans in that district that are not happy with this appointment as well. So I'm not really sure where that statement really applies here. I think most people should be concerned about making sure that you're represented by people that live in your district.
Okay, let's go to your calls on this. Should the city councilman or woman that represents you be a resident of the district? The law says so. What are your thoughts about this? 549-2937. Bobby is on the north side. Hi, Bobby. Good morning.
Good morning, y'all. Remember a case where a Jack Daniels challenged the residency of I think the guy's name is Jay Jarbo.
Yeah, he's passed away now. Yeah.
And it was determined that, you know, just because you call a place your primary residence, the court determined that it wasn't his primary residence. And by renting these rooms in District 10, it's the same scenario, even worse. And, let me ask you how the people in Mandarin would feel if they appointed a Democrat to represent them. you'd be hearing howling to the moon about it. So, and going to the general counsel, everybody knows when the general counsel opens his mouth, the mayor speaks.
Okay, thanks for that. So if the situation were reversed, what about his analogy that he just made?
Well, yeah, I think he has a great point there. And also talk to his point about residency. I'll put on my law cap for a second. And, you know, legal residency is basically a convergence of intent and fact. Basically, you can just because you registered to vote someplace doesn't mean you're a resident. You have to show and prove that you actually intend to live there. And people can make the argument by just renting two bedrooms in a house with a family of six that you don't really intend to live there. And so I think those questions are all valid. I think it's unprecedented, too, as he was saying with the general counsel, the city has never really joined a lawsuit like this before. And so I think it's interesting that they're willing to do this.
It is interesting. Basically, they're filing a motion and whether or not that will be effective, we'll have to see. And whether or not Brenda Priestley Jackson's lawsuit will be effective, we'll watch closely, too. But lots of calls on this, no surprise. AJ is in McClenny. AJ, hello.
Good morning. I think my question was answered already. Hello, can y'all hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think my question was answered already. But I was just wondering, is Terrence Freeman actually living in the room that he rented, or he just got a mailing address to those rooms in District 10? Is he required to live there? Is
yeah.
By law?
Right. Let's talk about that. So Mr. Freeman rented a couple of rooms in District 10 to fulfill the residency requirement. Will he actually live in those rooms, or will he continue to live in Mandarin?
I mean, that's a question that he'll have to answer, but he legally he does need to live there. So that means he needs to reside there. He needs to go to bed there. I mean, that's what that means.
There have been other instances, as a caller pointed out, of public officials technically fulfilling a residency requirement with a wink and a nod, but they didn't actually live in the district that they purported to represent. This wouldn't be the first time we've seen this, but this, for a number of reasons, this one has become a bigger flare up of controversy than some of the other battles over residency, you know, that we've seen in the past. Why do you think this one has cut such a nerve?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things is I think the differences in the communities that people came from. A lot of times in those issues, you're living in a district or a neighborhood that's right next to a district. But when you're living in Mandarin and you're living in Northwest Jacks, those are completely different neighborhoods. And I think the fact that he's also a Republican doesn't help as well, because that district is 60% Democrat.
And that's not being challenged legally, by the way.
That is not.
But that's sort of a subtext.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And by the way, the new Councilman Freeman is having a town hall tomorrow night at the Legends Center. I think that's on Soutelle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So people can come out and meet him and talk to him about this.
And I think, and like I said, I've spoken to a lot of people in the district, and I think the first thing you'd want to do is go meet him and talk to him and voice your concerns. I think that's the best way to kind of have him understand why people are upset.
Let's go to Lee on the north side. Hey, Lee, how are you today?
I'm doing fine, Melissa. How are you?
Okay.
Good. I just wanted to weigh in on this. I don't think the district needs a carpetbagger. There are plenty of viable candidates in that district that could have been chosen by the governor. And if he wanted to choose a Republican, he still could have chosen a Republican that actually lived in that district.
Do you live in the district, Lee?
I used to. I'm no longer in the district. I moved further out into the suburbs, but my parents still live in that district, and I'm very involved in that district because that district has a lot of social ills. They still have septic tanks.
Yeah.
They don't. It's still a food desert.
Right.
Crime is high because a lot of people don't have access to services. So for someone to come in from Mandarin and try to lead that district, I just think it's a farce. And I know he's having a meet and greet at the Legends Center. I just hope he knows the directions to get there.
All right. Oh, a little shade from Lee there. Okay. Okay. He's echoing your point, OB. If the governor really wanted a Republican to hold the seat, he's saying residents in the district are saying there were people who could have fulfilled that in the district. Terrence Freeman is a guy that had forged a lot of key connections. And that seems, I think, to have made the difference.
Yeah, here. I mean, he's connected in the Republican Party here locally, and I think that helps. I think the mayor's office wanted him as well, and so I think that makes a difference.
Daniel is downtown. Hi, Daniel. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment, but also I want to encourage reporters to really look at this. It's very interesting that general counsel decided to step in the case, because if you look at how the attorneys of record, at least for Freeman, have changed in the past week, it's already changed twice. So the fact that the city council decided to step in, it leaves an interesting story out there that's not being told. And the fact that in his the complaint that was filed by the general counsel's office, that they said that Freeman was acting in his capacity as a council member, it also leaves the question open that is general counsel going to be defending Terrence Freeman's face from attack?
Yeah, okay. Thanks for that. Let's talk about what's going on with this in terms of the city trying to intervene, OB. What we see from the mayor's office with the mayor's former political consultant, Tim Baker, by the way, running a number of city council campaigns, critics say is a really strong effort to consolidate power on the city council so that the mayor has a reliable voting bloc on the council to help carry out, one would presume, his second term agenda.
Well, I think you know, what the caller was referencing was the actual motion that the city filed. And part of that motion, the motion to intervene, was basically the city was saying that they are the only people that can certify if someone is eligible to be on city council. And so it's going to be an interesting case to see that, because in a sense, they're going to be the ones that are going to be defending Terrence in this case, because if that motion is granted, right? And so they're trying to step in the case and say, we are the only people that can actually decide that. As far as consolidating power, this is clearly an effort to make sure that there are people that are friendly to the mayor's office in those seats. And so we'll see how that plays out. I think, like you said, this is unprecedented that the mayor's office would even join this type of suit.
State Senator Audrey Gibson, the Senate Minority Leader in Tallahassee from Jacksonville, is quoted on Jacksonville.com saying, "The real message from this appointment is that the rules only apply to some people and the rest should keep quiet and go pound sand." I don't think so.
I mean, I think if you look at some of the comments that have come out, that people are from city council, and that they're upset that there would be a lawsuit about this and that people should be happy that they have representation. I think that's what that's being echoed out in the community. And the people in District 10 are like, we've had enough. We want someone from our district to represent us.
Rachel tweets the show, "I am so sick of this naked corruption from our Florida political system. They either think we're really stupid or they count on inaction, enabling them to get away with it." Here's an email from Andy. "The governor's appointment to this seat is exactly the sort of cynical, politically motivated move that has propelled the Republicans into power at every level of our government. Politically effective, no doubt, but completely lacking in concern for the voters of a district they consider outside of their core constituency." Okay, but let's say Terrence Freeman does an admirable job representing the voters of District 10. Will the concern fade away?
I don't think so. I think what the issue with all these type of points is that Terrence could do a great job, but that doesn't mean someone from District 10 couldn't have done a better job. And I think the voters want to feel like they're a part of the process. They also want to feel like they're being adequately represented. They don't want a learning curve for someone who's in to learn the district before they start representing them.
Here is a comment on our Facebook page from Jay. "The appointment of a well-connected Republican to a seat in a district he neither lived in nor was represented by his party is the epitome of the problem with Jacksonville. Those in power always take whatever they want by whatever means they deem fit. This is why Jacksonville is a city of perpetual potential that has yet to realize all that it could be. It is always short-term gains over long-term action."
I mean, I don't disagree with that. I think what people are frustrated by this. I mean, they feel like the government, the governor and now the mayor's office aren't really listening to people in District 10. And I think if you look at all of your comments, people from every other district are saying, why couldn't he pick somebody from District 10?
Jim is in Riverside. Let's go to Jim now. Hey, Jim, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. As far in terms of next year's election, it's my understanding that the qualified candidate needs to live in that district for a year. So even if it's determined that Mr. Freeman can it qualifies for this appointment, is it your understanding as well that he will not be able to qualify for election in that district, even if his residency was established recently? He doesn't meet the year from filing date requirement. Is that correct?
No, it's 183 days prior to the qualification that he needs to be a resident. So that's kind of, in a sense, going to be, I assume that would be part of the lawsuit as well, is whether or not he established proper residency there. And if he doesn't meet the 183 days, definitely not.
Mike in Arlington. Hi, Mike. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Always love listening to the show.
Thanks.
So, a lot of those recent comments kind of echo where I was coming from, but I think I really don't understand why there wasn't a process already in place with the local government to deal with a situation that didn't require a governor intervening and installing somebody of his choosing, which is just, that's just beyond the pale. This is so outside the bounds of what should be reasonable. What is the governor doing picking and choosing a city council person? Seriously, what in one city? That's just, wow, that just boggles the imagination that the governor could even get away with doing that. And I just I'm not sure I understand where the governor was able to do that in the first place.
Let's explain the chain of events. Thanks for the call, Mike. Okay, so going back a bit, two city council members, Reggie Brown and Katrina Brown, no relation to each other, both came under the scrutiny of the feds. They are both facing federal fraud charges. They refused to resign from their seats, which triggered these emergency appointments, correct,
Obi, correct,
from the governor? Let's explain why the governor is involved in this.
So Florida statute allows the governor to suspend local officials if they've been indicted, right? And once that happens, it's then up to the local charter to decide the process in which those suspended officials will be replaced. Jacksonville doesn't have a system in the city charter that speaks on that, right? What happens is then bumped back up to the governor to be able to decide that.
Yeah, because we don't have a local mechanism.
Correct. Correct.
While they're suspended, we had no mechanism for a replacement. And by the way, there was a mad scramble of people who wanted these appointments from the governor. Local names and faces people might recognize, people who've held office before or saw an opportunity to get into public office for the first time.
Right. And I think in the lawsuit, I think there was 10 to 15 eligible people from District 10 that were on there. And like I said before, almost when this process started, you had to be from that district to be able to put your name on that. And that process changed midway.
Right. So it was the moving of the goalposts, I guess, that has irked so many people.
I agree.
Okay. 549-2937. Natalie is on the north side. Natalie, good morning. Natalie, put your radio down and go ahead and talk to us. Okay. She's listening on the radio. Natalie, you're going to hear this in about 10 seconds. Give us a call back. We'll talk a little bit longer to try to give her a chance to call us. A few more emails and tweets. Here's one from Chad. The governor's lack of communication and transparency in Mr. Freeman's appointment process to serve the residents of District 10 on the Jacksonville City Council only continues to reinforce the criticism against our city's lack of accessibility and transparency, as detailed in the June Task Force on Open Government final report. In my opinion, this appointment is less about Republican, but rather more about resident. We cannot discount, though, the mayor's desire to consolidate his power to advance his agenda. I'm sure Mr. Freeman is a good man, and I reject any threats against him as a person. Let's talk about that, too. There were some threats made. But I urge citizens on both sides of the aisle to demonstrate values where many in Washington have failed, civility and public debate on the issue with constituents. There have been some threats that have come out around this.
Yeah, I don't know if I would declare those as threats. The comment that was made by Pastor Gundy was basically that we should protest. And I think that's being blown up.
That was
up.
Interpreted as a threat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And to Terrence's point, I mean, if Terrence really wants to represent that district, he's going to have to show that he's not just a yes man for the mayor. And I think if he really wants to stay in that district and people, he wants the people in the district to respect him, he's going to have to show that he's not just going to say yes to whatever the mayor says.
And just to clarify what you mentioned a minute ago, the Republican Party of Duval called on the Democratic Party to put a stop to a local organizer urging protests at Councilman Freeman's home. So that's what the reference was to. Okay. Harmon is along the South Bank. Harmon, hello.
Good morning, Dr. Ross. Welcome home. Welcome back. Glad you're here.
How you doing, Harmon?
I'm doing fine now that the doctor is back in her seat.
That's right. I think you would not want to be treated by me, man.
I hear you, Doc. Well, hey, I think the process is already in place, and it's amazing. It's called at-large council representatives, where you have five. And those five are supposed to be helping to give leadership and lead those districts and prior to the latest council president, I think, Mr. Bowman, council president Anna Brochet and Sam Newby were representing those districts, and then they rescinded them back to at-large council districts. And when you look at, I guess, the charter, those at-large districts were put in place to, I guess, facilitate should something like this happen, or if a council person got ill and couldn't finish. And if that's not the case, then maybe we should at law.
Yep. We lost him. But what about his comments?
Yeah, I think there's I agree partly. I think the district needs their own representation. At large is helpful, but they need their own people that are dedicated to just their needs. And I think that's kind of why that split up like that. I think it was admirable for Anna Brochet and Councilman Newby to kind of help step in at that time. And I'm not really sure why they were taking off. It didn't make much sense to do that, but you know, they need their own representation. They need someone dedicated that's going to answer their phones and just be focused on their needs.
Okay. So as we watch to see where this goes from here, what are your final thoughts?
I think the people, there's a tremendous amount of people that are upset by this appointment, and I think they need to make their voice heard, not only to Terrence, but to the mayor's office as well, and let people understand why they really wanted somebody from their district to represent them.
Lawyer, political strategist Obi Umuna, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, much more still ahead. Later, it's the latest phase of the city's urban arts project. We'll meet the artists. Getting their names for the first time here on the show. But up next, Neptune Beach residents are mad about their own issue, a new development in their community. We'll tell you about it right after this.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. It's hurricane season. Prepare now by learning your evacuation zone, updating your disaster kit to include water, non-perishable food items, a flashlight with extra batteries, a radio, and other important items. Pick up a 2018 Hurricane Preparedness Guide at your public library and visit jacksready.com for more information. Tune your radio to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
Now, Moses and I had won Goldie at the Tennessee State Fair the fall before. And he was so proud. You know, it only cost us $10 worth of freaking ping pong balls to win this fish that's worth less than a dollar on the open market. Join us for stories of all the ways we say goodbye. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at 12 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, we're going to the beach, Miami Beach, for the Ground Up Music Festival.
Yeah, so far it's like paradise, you know, for me anyway.
With the Flecktones, Joshua Redman, Leonel Uwake, and more. I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's expected to be a packed house tonight at Fletcher High School over a controversial project out at the beaches called 500 Atlantic. The Neptune Beach Development Community Review Board. Man, that's a mouthful. Well, anyway, this board will hear public input and will probably take a vote on this proposed project. It's at the site of the old Kmart near 3rd Street in Neptune Beach. Developers want to build 175 apartments and a 74-bedroom hotel on the site. Supporters say this will revitalize a long-closed structure, but there are many opponents to 500 Atlantic. They say this development is too dense, will cause parking snarls, and is not in keeping with the character of Neptune Beach. Now, we invited Tribridge Residential Principal Catherine Mosley to appear on the show. She is the spokesperson for the project, but she's actually flying in from Atlanta for tonight's meeting. We interviewed her late last week about 500 Atlantic. Here is an excerpt of that interview.
Living in other cities and traveling to other places, you see really cool concept places kind of popping up everywhere. And I think the more of that that can come to the beaches or really any neighborhood in Jacksonville is only going to make it a better place to not only visit, but also live. So whether that be restaurants or fitness facilities or retail, specialty grocery stores, anything that is brought to the community that makes people want to frequent it more, I think is needed.
Now, not only that, Ms. Mosley pointed out that there have been several changes made to the site design because there's been such strong pushback from the Neptune Beach community. They've revised plans so code variances are no longer requested. They've scaled down the number of residences and other changes. Still, though, there's strong opposition. Joining us in studio is Rick Duncan. He represents Neptune Beach Strong, a group that opposes the 500 Atlantic development, and he joins us in studio. Hey, Rick, good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And so we've heard the case for from the developer Tribridge, apartments, boutique hotel, slick new development. Why is there such strong opposition, though, out at the beaches to this?
You know, what's interesting to me is listening to that recording. I don't disagree with a lot of what was laid out there. I think our residents can get behind a vibrant, mixed-use, walkable community. Our concern is about the density here. The one thing that she failed to mention was the apartment complex, and I don't know that she mentioned the hotel. This is a very dense 175 apartments plus 74 hotel rooms. So initially, the proposal was over 300 apartments, and then they got feedback from the community, reduced the number to 199, and they even dropped the height of the back building that is adjacent to Neptune by the Sea down to a two-story building. So they were making some effort to come in our direction. The latest plan, however, takes that back building back up to three stories. Yes, the apartment number went down from 199 to 175, but they added a 74-room hotel. So I personally don't see any density difference between a one-bedroom apartment and a hotel room. I could argue that two queen beds in a hotel room could easily support a family of four coming to vacation at the beach. So I feel like we've seen an increase in density in the new plan, and a high density apartment complex is just not in the character of Neptune Beach.
You want to keep it small, relaxed. You're saying, is it your concern that this would increase traffic? What's the big concern?
Well, there's several concerns built around the density issue. Certainly, we have issues with parking at the Beaches Town Center already. And I don't think there's any way you can get around the fact that an addition of 249, let's call them habitable units, will not increase the amount of traffic and exacerbate the parking problems that are there. The developer would tell you that they've put in a parking garage that's going to be open to the public. However, when you count the number of spaces, there's only 5 more spaces than the developer is required to provide just to meet the demands of their own development. So we're really still having a significant problem. An additional issue is the hotel is on the back part of the property, and they see a pedestrian crossing at Lemon Street. Now, this is crossing 3rd Street, Highway A1A. You've already got traffic and pedestrians that cross at Atlantic and A1A. And they recently put up a year or two ago a sign that says yield to pedestrians because it was a dangerous intersection. Now about 165, 170 feet down the street, you're going to have another cross path where vacationers, I presume, who would be staying at the hotel will be looking to access the beaches. Now, the developer said there's going to be some improvements there, but the reality is you've got 2 pedestrian crosswalks very close to each other on the busiest street in our town. It's just a bad idea.
Okay. What would you say to those listening who would take the opposite view that, hey, look, it's a beautiful beach community. It's growing. People have to live somewhere. Why not build apartments near the beach and attract more residents to the beach? And why not at least build something there other than an empty, abandoned Kmart, which is what it is now?
You know, that's a straw man argument, Melissa. No one is in suggesting that we leave it undeveloped. It's a very valuable property. As you said, it's near the ocean. It's in the heart of the North Beaches community. Something is going to go there. So we're certainly not advocating keep a derelict property. I have no issue with a single floor of loft apartments built above retail, restaurants, professional offices. But the idea that you're going to stack 2 stories of apartments on top of a hotel and put that down next to the busiest intersection in town, to me, that's completely outside the character of our small beach town that we all love and enjoy.
What is the character of Neptune Beach?
It's primarily single-family residential. If you look at the city's comprehensive plan, which is the guidepost for all development decisions, it specifically characterizes the area west of 3rd Street as primarily single-family residential. The only apartment complex we have of this scale is Ocean Oaks, completely on the other end of town. Mm-hmm. So I think we can have one of these cool mixed developments with some people that live and work there. But this company that's doing it, they specialize in apartment development. And that's what that's the paradigm. That's their skill set. So that's what this leans too heavily toward. We think this needs to go back to the drawing board, scale it down some. Definitely get the hotel out of there. That only contributes to greater density. And let's come up with a plan we can all get behind.
And the vote is likely tonight on this. Let's go to a few calls. Mr. Brown, what's your first name, Mr. Brown, out at the beaches?
Hi, I'm Will Brown. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, my concern is we have a out-of-state residential developer who has no experience in commercial coming in and putting in his residential development right at the heart of a congested area in our town center. And the commercial property beneath the hotels has low ceilings, and it's not going to attract high-quality commercial investors to come in. And the fact that this residential area is bringing in about 10% of Neptune Beach's population in that highly condensed area really has me concerned.
All right, thanks for that. Steven in Atlantic Beach. Go ahead, Steven.
Hi. I just wanted to say that this development is on, I believe it's 7.5 acres of land, and all of these buildings. They also own, Tribridge owns the next piece of land where Lucky's Market is. And they are also buying the Bellarmine property, which is behind this property. and the Sportsplex property. What this means is if this goes through, if they're given a special exception to create a planned unit development, then that sets the precedent for the next piece of their property to have a planned unit development. And then when they combine the other two pieces of property, there comes another planned unit development. We're not opposed to growth in Neptune, Atlantic Beach, and Jacksonville Beach. We just don't want to see this kind of intense and too dense development.
Okay, thanks, Stephen. Yes. And I have a little more information that was sent to me, Rick, from a representative of the developer. And lots of talking points here, but here's one for you. They write, one of the strongest benefits of the mixed-use model is the ability to incorporate appropriate density, which actually encourages the small-town feel that Neptune Beach officials and residents desire to maintain. Contrary to popular belief about density being a negative factor for development, a density of at least 10 residential units per acre is ideal for a walkable development such as 500 Atlantic. According to the author of the book Walkable Cities, 500 Atlantic would have 11 units per acre. All right, we're getting into the weeds a little bit of some of their specs. But as we go back and forth on this, this occurs to me that this flap in Neptune Beach is really the story of Florida. It's a microcosm of Florida, which is nonstop growth and development and building of something. And then I mean, I can't count the number of strip malls in this state I've driven by where there were businesses there. They go under, something new gets built right over it. You can't even remember what used to be on the site 10 or 20 years ago. You and Neptune Beach are trying to halt that trend in your beach, or at least slow it down in your beach community, it sounds like.
Look, we all understand that there is a shift in the retail market space, the growth in online retailers such as Amazon, Etsy, Wayfair. This has really changed the buying habits of a lot of Americans. So I understand that the traditional concept of big box real strip malls is not the right solution moving forward. And again, the design principles behind a walkable mixed-use community are not something that we object to. However, we are not short of residents or pedestrians or activity in the Neptune Beach and the Beaches Town Center area. That's something we're certainly not short on. There's plenty of more apartments that are going up. Tribridge just built another apartment complex just down the road, the cottages. There's a lot more planned. Things that are just on the other side of the intracoastal. These are people that are going to feed into the Beaches Town Center and continue to grow the area. So I don't feel like we're short on residents or in need of additional hotel to drive traffic through the businesses that would occupy the development.
Now, with all of that said, there is a meeting on this tonight. It's the city's Community Development Review Board in Neptune Beach. They're going to consider the proposal, get public input at this meeting tonight at 6 o'clock at Fletcher High School. From the looks of things, they're going to get a lot of input, Rick.
I think so. I would encourage everyone to please turn out and make your voices heard.
And will they vote tonight?
The Community Development Board will vote tonight. They are not the final word on the project. They make a recommendation to the City Council, and the City Council will have the final vote later in the summer.
Rick Duncan of Neptune Beach Strong, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
In a moment, how you can be part of Jacksonville's Urban Arts Project. That's after this.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com. The Jacksonville Record and Observer. Introducing a new weekly business newspaper. News, trends, and analysis for your business to thrive in Northeast Florida. Delivered each Thursday throughout downtown Jacksonville. More at jacksdailyrecord.com.
The Trump administration wants to detain all unauthorized immigrants, but others are calling for flexibility.
A nursing mother waiting for a ultimate hearing is not a threat to public safety. A member of a drug cartel who has been in the country legally and has been apprehended by ICE is a threat to public safety.
Immigration detention this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
1, 2, 3, 4, Trump declares a trade war.
We put a $50 billion tariff on, then we put a $100 billion tariff on. And you know, at a certain point, they run out of bullets.
But this week, the EU and Japan pursue bilateral trade agreements without him. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
When President Trump praised Russian President Vladimir Putin, some of the swiftest criticism came from Mr. Trump's party.
I just felt like the president's comments made us look as a nation more like a pushover.
Where are Republicans on the president today? And how can they express their dissent without alienating the president's supporters? Next time on 1A. Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it is your chance to be part of Jacksonville's Urban Arts Project. Tomorrow at the Jack's Makerspace at the main library, you can meet some of the artists who've been chosen to create some really interesting public art to liven up the city's urban core. We've got a preview right now as we welcome one of the artists, Karen Kuricki, and also hear Christy Holacek, Director of Art in Public Places. Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
All right, Christy, let's start with you. This is phase two of the Urban Arts Project. You're going to have a Meet the Artist kickoff tomorrow night at the library. Let's explain, though, first what the Urban Arts Project is all about.
Sure. I tell you, we're really excited about phase two kicking off. In about 2015, we worked with the Downtown Investment Authority to create an urban arts project that would be three phased and over several years, and it would roll out in the downtown urban core. And the purpose of this was to work with artists, almost creating bridge projects at a kind of a small to medium scale that we could install at the street level with the community.
And the theme of this is illumination. JEA is even a partner. So this public art will go along with the theme of illuminating the cityscape, I guess?
Definitely. So the great part about public art is that it is site specific. So not only does it kind of take the identity from the public and their dialogue and feedback, but it also represents the city. So that site area, phase two, is the Elbow District or the Entertainment District. So it makes a lot of sense to illuminate that and bring that vibrancy to that space.
And these projects feature things like vinyl wrapped traffic signal cabinets. So you wrap the traffic cabinet in something cool, sculptural bike racks, outdoor sculptures, sculptural seating, public art that people will see just as they're going about their day.
Yes, it will be similar to the projects that you might have seen in phase one that are located down Hogan Street and Bay Street, and they lead into the urban core. So it'll definitely capture everyone's attention, but it'll also be interactive and functional in a way that you can actually use the piece of art at the same time.
It's such a great idea to sort of transform a utilitarian object into a work of art and enhance the visual landscape. Now, one of the artists you've selected is right here in studio, Karen Kuricki. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa.
You have five artist-designed vinyl wraps that are going to be part of this. Where can people see them, and can you describe them for us a little bit?
So they'll be scattered all throughout the Elbow District. And as of now, I don't necessarily know what they'll be because we have to have the meeting with the public to kind of get their feedback on the Elbow District and what they envision for the district. But my work is pretty vibrant, bold, colorful, and positive. So hoping it will kind of tie into that. And I'm excited to meet the other artists as well tonight.
Yeah. So everyone will meet this week on the 19th, and you're going to unveil the other artists at that time, but you want to say their names now, don't you?
I'd love to say their names now, for sure. So as you mentioned, there's a variety of different projects, and I have a nice list here. So, of course, Karen Kuricki, we're so happy to have you for our traffic signal cabinets. Eric Moed, Samuel Maddox, and Kayla Moed will actually be installing the bicycle lighting and working with the bike ped coordinator for the city of Jacksonville. They're out of Boston. Shasti O'Leary Sudant, she is from Buffalo, New York, and she will be creating the environmental sculpture. And then lastly, Casey O'Connell, she is actually a former student of Flagler College, went to California and is now in Atlanta, Georgia. She will be putting the 2D surface applications, the lighting and the projection on those surfaces in those areas.
This is, and as you go through downtown Jacksonville, you really do see the difference over the last few years of how public art has really brightened up so many streets around town. So this is an extension of that, which is exciting to see.
It sure is. This is really a kickoff to a number of projects that are certainly going to have a ripple effect from the downtown core into the neighborhoods in the city of Jacksonville. So we're ready to have the community involved to shape the identity of our city.
And the kickoff is tomorrow night. Meet the artists, 6 o'clock in the Jax Maker Space at the main library. Open to the public. Anyone can come out?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, kudos to you both. Karen Kuricki, one of the artists chosen. Christy Holacek, Director of Art in Public Places. It's phase two of Jacksonville's Urban Arts Project, transforming the urban core with public art. Ladies, thanks so much for being here, and kudos.
Thank you so
much.
Thank
you. Have a good day.
All right, and that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Next on 1A, Republican reaction after Helsinki. Is President Trump's modified position on Russia's role in the 2016 U.S. election enough to ease criticism from his fellow Republicans? That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow with a brand new show. If you're listening to our rebroadcast, which is every night at 8 o'clock, just keep listening for David Luckin in the Electro Lounge. He's on every night at 9. Have a great day, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.